when I was being most honest about the things that had been most difficult for me and that I felt were most personal, those are the moments that have turned out to have the greatest connection. And that has been a really wonderful realization for me, because it's made me realize that actually, if I'm more myself, not less, if I lean into the absolute truthfulness of who I am, that's when good stuff happens.
Welcome to In Writing, a new podcast that gets into the heads and the studies of writers of all kinds, from novelists to screenwriters to poets. I'm Hattie Crissell. I'm a journalist based in London, and I started this podcast because I've always had endless questions for other writers. How did they get started? Do they sit down with fully formed ideas, or are they freestyling as they go along? What have they learned from years of honing their work, and what can we learn from them? My first guest is the multi-talented Elizabeth Day, journalist, novelist, podcaster, and memoirist. Elizabeth was a feature writer for The Observer when in 2012 she published her first novel. She writes in her memoir How to Fail about the daunting decision she eventually made to leave that job and become a full-time author, and we talk about that in this episode too. She's now published four novels, most recently 2017's The Party. Last year she launched How to Fail with Elizabeth Day, a podcast on which she's interviewed everyone from Phoebe Waller-Bridge to Lily Allen about their failures and what they learned from them. And in the memoir that followed, she wrote frankly and movingly about her own. I visited Elizabeth at her then home in Kentish Town, North London, on a stormy summer day. She showed me into the light-filled, cosy front room of her flat, where her writing desk sat in a bay window. So, over to Elizabeth. So I'm here in North London in this beautiful front room of a flat, which is your kitchen, living space and study, I think, Elizabeth Day.
Yes, it is. It's all of those things, Hattie. It's small but perfectly formed.
It's beautiful and really light and airy. So will you describe this space for me in your words?
Yeah. So this flat is very special to me because I started renting it when I was coming out of a marriage. So it was my flat to get through that patch of time between divorce and whatever's going to happen next. And it's a rented flat. And that was important to me because I didn't know what was going to happen next. So I wanted the sort of flexibility and agility of a rented flat. But when I came to view it, I fell in love with the light. So the room that we're in has a bay window. And in front of my bay window, I've put my desk. The previous tenants had a small dining table there. And I wanted actually to make the focus of the room the desk and the fact that I was going to be writing there. Yeah. And that it was very much, it felt very much like a room of my own, as Virginia Woolf sort of famously claimed authors and particularly women needed. And it really felt like that to me. It felt I was striking out independently and I was able to hang the pictures that I wanted to hang exactly where I wanted to hang them and have my books out again. I'd spent a year sort of living in other people's houses and Airbnbs, so it was really lovely to unpack. So the other notable feature is that I've got four bookshelves on one wall, which are crammed with books. And that's only a small fraction of the books that I own. And then there are two sofas in a kind of L shape, and above the back of my sofa, the one that I'm sitting on, is it's an oil painting of a woman with a swan and a dog. And that was painted by my grandmother, who was an artist.
Oh, it's so lovely. So the painting's obviously one of your favourite things. What else in this room is really special to you? And particularly when you're writing.
Yes. So I like to look at beautiful things when I'm writing, and I'm lucky that I have a really calming view because I'm on a residential street, but there's no through traffic because it's a dead end. And there's another road leading down, and beyond that there's just wide open space, and I can imagine Hampstead Heath in the distance. So the view is really important. Also the fact that there are lots of lovely cats on this road.
Oh.
So occasionally when I'm writing and I need inspiration to strike me, I'll just focus on a sort of gambolling cat. There's one opposite who's particularly fat and grey, who I get a lot of enjoyment from. And then actually on my desk is one of my most special things, which is a perpetual calendar, which was my grandfather's, and it's in French actually because my grandmother was Swiss. And I loved my grandfather greatly, and I have a lot of his possessions. So, but that desk calendar reminds me of him on a daily basis. So that's very special to me.
That's lovely. So you said before we started recording that you don't actually do all of your writing here. Where else do you write?
So I tend to do a lot of my kind of journalistic writing here at my desk. But often when I'm writing fiction, I like to go elsewhere because I like to be around the buzz and murmur of other people. Because writing can be such a solitary activity. And actually in my fiction, I seek to explore what makes us human and how we connect with each other. So it's good for me to be around people sometimes.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky in that I can motivate with I can motivate myself even with background noise.
You
I find
don't
it
get
quite
distracted.
Not really. The thing that I find distracting is sort of annoying music, overly loud music in cafes. And if that happens, I listen to... I'm going to sound so pretentious, but I listen to Mozart's Requiem. It's one of those pieces of music. I think classical music, I find it much easier to write to because...
I completely agree, because there's no lyrics.
Exactly. I get too distracted by the lyrics.
Yeah.
And Mozart's Requiem is a piece of music. It would be my desert island piece of music. And it took me through my finals. It took me through lots of revision. So I will tune into that. So the cafes that I write in are kind of, there's one Kentish Town cafe near the station called Saint Espresso, which I love, although it always closes really early. It closes at 5 p.m. and sometimes I only get my shit together at kind of around 4. So I like to go there. And then, do you know what? I love Starbucks. I know,
really?
I know I'm not allowed to say that, but it's just, there's something so straightforward about Starbucks. I know what I'm going to get every single time.
You just said you don't get your shit together till 4 o'clock sometimes. So you're not one of these people who gets up at 6 a.m. and gets all their writing done by 9:30 or something.
No, I'm definitely not. I will get up early if I have a journalism deadline. And I will often do that. I mean, 6 a.m. I have done in the past, but it's kind of pushing it. I like my sleep.
Yeah.
But with fiction and writing books, I tend to do that in the afternoon or the early evening. And it's partly a hangover from old. So I wrote my first novel when I was on staff at The Observer, and I would have to do my journalism first and get that out of the way. And then I would carve out a couple of hours free, and they would always be in the kind of later afternoon. And that's how I could do it without feeling stressed or guilty.
Yeah.
And so that's, yeah, that's kind of hung around. But when I wrote How to Fail, the other place I love to write is LA. That's less practical on a daily basis. But I did go to LA because the deadline was very tight for How to Fail. And I was house sitting for a friend. And when I'm just writing a book or a novel, when I'm just doing that and I've gone away somewhere, then I will get up and straight away start writing.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love the freedom that comes with that. But I like the fact that it's also an exceptional occurrence in my daily life because it feels very special. Mm-hmm. I think if I were just writing books full time, I would probably miss the discipline of journalism. And I think they feed, for me, they feed into each other quite well.
Yeah. How many hours of writing can you do in a day? Are you someone who can, you know, really power at it all day long?
No. And I'm intrigued by people who say that they can, because I think it's one of those things that it's like Ribena. It's always better when it's stronger and less diluted. I love Ribena. No. So I think I can write for 2 hours is probably my maximum in one sitting. And if I'm away, so for instance, when I was writing How to Fail in LA, or when I went away to write the beginning and the end of Paradise City, which is my third novel, I went to Cornwall, and I can do 2 hours in the morning, and then I will take a lunch break where I will do some form of exercise, whether it's sort of walking along a Cornish clifftop or going to a yoga class or something. And then I'll come back and I'll be able to do 2 hours in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And that's the maximum for me.
That's a great day's work, I think.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
But that's exceptional. And I've always said to myself that it doesn't matter. Psychologically, the way that I work is that I need to think it doesn't matter how many hours, it's what I produce. So every time I sit down to my laptop and write a bit of a book, I try to write 1,000 words. And that's the deal that I have with myself.
Right. Do you ever hit a wall where you just cannot write that 1,000 words?
Rarely, she said, touching wood. Quite rarely, because that's the thing about being a journalist is that you're so used to having to write on demand and to write to deadline and get those words out that I try to suspend critical judgment. If I'm having a really hard day, I will just try and get the words on the screen and know that the next time I sit down and read it back, I can edit it myself. And there's a liberation that comes with that. So
do you ever hit a wall of, I just don't know what's going to happen next when you're writing a novel? Or do you have that all planned out beforehand?
I'm not a planner, so I often don't know what's going to happen next, but that doesn't, I find that stimulating rather than blocking.
Yeah.
So I sort of, apart from The Party, so The Party was my fourth novel, my most recent novel, and The Party is very tightly plotted. And so I did have to plan it more, but again, my process was to get into the book and into the characters first and then start plotting it once I knew who the people were. Mm-hmm. And so, and I like the freedom that comes from not quite knowing and leaving yourself space and leaving your character space to lead you somewhere and do something that you might not expect. And I always thought before I wrote novels, particularly, that when people said, oh, I just don't know what my characters are going to do, I don't know where they're going to lead me, I thought that was so pretentious and ridiculous. And then I wrote my first novel, Scissors, Paper, Stone, and this character did something that I had not planned at all for him to do. And it completely changed the tenor of the book. And I was like, oh, that's what I want to write about. So I think it's really important for me personally to be able to do that.
When do you first remember writing as a child?
So I remember loving books when I was four, because I was very privileged in that respect. I grew up in a house surrounded by books, and both my parents read to me and told me stories. And I remember loving books, and I remember wanting to write books at the age of four. But in terms of when I first remember loving writing, this is going to make me sound unbearably precocious, but you know, when I was seven, I was kind of had these great ideas for what I thought would be brilliant novels. And I wrote something called The Adventures of Daisy Day.
That's so lovely.
It was all sort of obviously handwritten, because this was basically a pre-computer era. And on pieces of lined A4 in a blue ring binder. In fact, I've got it here. I should show it to you.
I'd love to see it.
And it's got on the front, I've sort of cut out I've cut out letters from coloured paper, and the letters spell novel. So I clearly had this.
So sweet.
So I remember doing that, and I remember and then when I was 12, I got a column on a local newspaper. But it was because I did love writing, and I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And so I wrote to this local newspaper editor, and he gave me a chance, which was amazing. And I loved that. That was really fun doing it was meant to be a children's column, and it was every 2 weeks. And I got a lot of joy from making jokes in print and seeing people's response to it and expressing something that I wanted to express and then getting paid for it, which was incredible.
They paid you. That's fantastic.
They paid me £72. And I felt really valued because of it. And I got such a sense of empowerment. And I can remember spending that money on my first ever pair of DM boots. And I put purple laces in, and I just loved them.
Fabulous. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your first grown-up journalism job?
So I graduated from university, and I was going to go and do a kind of postgrad one-year journalism course or find a job on a local paper and hope that they would train me up. And as it happened, I went to the weirdest careers fair. I hate careers fairs. But my friend dragged me along, and she wanted to get into publishing. And it just so happened that there was this guy there as soon as I walked in on this slightly makeshift stall. And he was the deputy editor of the Londoner's Diary. And he offered me a week's work experience. So I went. I did a load of work experience and internships all through school and university. And I went, and someone had just left. And on the second day, I brought in quite a good story. And on the third day, I had an interview with the editor of the Evening Standard, who then was Max Hastings. And they hired me by the end of the week.
God.
Again, I don't know how easily that would happen now. And I'm so grateful for that break, because for a year I spent my time going to quite glamorous parties, which wasn't as fun as it sounds. It was quite intimidating. But bowling up to celebrities and asking them something that would hopefully make the next day's paper, writing it up to a tight deadline with a limited amount of words and trying to entertain and amuse a reader. And it taught me a lot of skills.
Yeah, what an incredible training.
Yeah.
So you're a journalist still. You're a novelist. You're a memoirist now. And also you're a podcaster, which we can talk about later. But would you go through those three types of writing one by one for me and just explain how those experiences of doing that work differ from your point of view?
So with journalism, your reader and your audience, I think, always has to be at the heart of how you write. So journalism, I started out, as I said, in the London's Diary, and then I got a job as a news reporter at the Sunday Telegraph. And obviously, when you're a news reporter, you can't put in all of your lovely turns of phrase and your florid adjectives. You need to communicate something really clearly that has all the facts in it, but it's also a smooth read. That has taught me a lot about structure in books. But I think that with that sort of journalism, I really had to kind of dial back my natural inclination to over describe. And that was a really good lesson for me. I then went into feature writing, and now I write a column. And obviously there's more scope there to bring your own voice in.
That's in You Magazine.
Yes. So I write a column for You Magazine, which I love doing. So it's a weekly column, and they've given me such free rein to talk about issues that are pertinent to women of my age in my particular situation. So I'm 40, I don't have children, I'm divorced, I've had fertility issues, and I think that there's an enormous amount of us, and a lot of us are silent because we feel a degree of shame about it. And I love that. It's sort of taken me back to my Derry Journal 12-year-old child's column days, where I can express myself and feel connection. So when I write a column, again, I'm much more concerned with expressing an idea concisely with clarity for a reader than I am with someone reading it and thinking, oh, what a great writer she is.
Yeah.
I want to convey an idea or something that someone else might be going through. And I want to do, and I've only got 700 words to do it. So that's really important, that there's still a sense of kind of rhythm, but it's clear. So I think that's the main thing. And also the fact that I write to deadline.
Yeah.
Is enormously important in journalism. So actually a lot of the time you don't have time to make things as beautiful as you would like to make them. You've got to fill the page, otherwise it's going to be like a blank page in a newspaper or magazine. But what I think the word that I've used a lot there is connection, the idea of connecting with a reader. And that is why I do everything I do, actually, just connecting with other people. So that is the same impetus in my novels and in my memoirs. But when I write a novel, there's much more time to play with, not only in terms of the time that I have to write it, but the time that a novel encompasses. So I have more freedom to write a lyrical sentence that I hope expresses something in a new or an interesting way. And with a novel, you have to think so much harder about the journey that your character is going on, the way the plot ties up. And that's a process of months rather than days or weeks. I still had to do that when I was writing long reportage pieces for The Observer, for instance. I still had to lead someone through. But that was 5,000 words and a novel is 100,000. So
it's a whole different ballgame.
It is, yeah. And then with memoir, it was really interesting because for me, it was such a great meshing of the two forms. I felt that it was a combination of journalism and a lot of the first person features I'd written and a novel where I needed to make it hang together as a whole. And I actually quite enjoyed writing it. I found it relatively straightforward to write because I was writing as me and I know myself. That's the great joy of getting older, is that I do finally, I think, quite know myself quite well. And so I wasn't writing a character that I had to invent, and I wasn't creating an entire fictional world. I had
so
the material.
The research part sort of falls away.
Exactly. I mean, there was research in the sense of, you know, recent statistics and all that sort of stuff, but all the material I needed and all the things that I wanted to write about, I had lived. And there was it was just so mind expanding writing from that place. And I realized I had a lot to say. So I think they're intimately connected, the three different formers, but those are probably the differences as well.
This is an awful question, but if I said for the rest of your career you can only do one of them, which one would you do?
Novels.
Really? You didn't even have to think about that. No. I thought you were going to say I refuse to choose.
No, I can choose. It's been an interesting journey for me because I did love writing House Vale, and I have been so bowled over and immensely moved and touched by the resonance it seems to have had with people. And the irony is that it's the most successful thing I've ever done, the podcast and the book. And it did make me think, am I naturally a long form non-fiction writer? Like, is this actually what I should be doing, and is it my ego that's driving me to sort of write novels? But I've thought a lot about it, and I don't think it is. It's novels are my passion, and I feel, again, no, I'm going to claim this word. I'm going to claim it. My vocation. Mm. And it's something I could never imagine not doing. But it is quite difficult to choose in that it's all writing. Like, I could basically never imagine myself not writing. Writing makes me feel my truest self.
Yeah.
And that's not to say, by the way, I would love to, I am going to write nonfiction again.
Yeah. But because you don't have to actually choose.
I don't have to choose. Yeah, I just had to say that out loud in case somehow it came true.
It was just a mind experiment. You write in How to Fail that your friend Viv told you, if you want to be Elizabeth Day novelist, you have to see yourself as Elizabeth Day novelist. She said that to you in the context of it was time for you to leave The Observer and throw yourself into the novels. How many novels had you published at that point?
Oh, I'm just trying to think which one I was. I think I'd published three. So Paradise City had just come out. And Paradise City was getting attention in America. And I had never had that before. So it was the People magazine book of the week and things like that.
That's
fantastic. And what was interesting about that was that we've chatted a bit about this in the past, Hattie, but I think I'd always been a bit embarrassed of seeing myself as a novelist, even though that's what I dearly wanted to do. And I think that in Britain, we're quite bad at allowing women to be lots of different things. And I was seen by a lot of people as a journalist and a star feature writer on The Observer. And in Britain, it felt like there were lots of people who therefore found it hard to give my novel the attention that I might have wanted for it. Mm. And so many reviews just referred to me as a journalist, which is fine because that is factually accurate, but also they were reviewing my novel. So yeah. I was at least as importantly a novelist. Whereas in America, they didn't know me as a journalist, and it was so freeing to just have the merits of the book taken as they were. And I remember Viv saying that to me. And at that time, I had been at The Observer maybe 6 years. So it took me like another 2 years to act on it. But I remember her saying that. And I also remember her introducing me to the concept of playing big. And that idea that as women, we should claim the space. We should stop fanning around, questioning ourselves and feeling imposter syndrome, because actually a lot of the time we're doing the stuff.
Yeah.
We're doing it, and we should be treated on that alone, the fact that we're doing it. And she told me all of this, and it took a while to percolate, but it was enormously helpful.
Yeah.
And like you, I made a decision to take a massive gamble and to go freelance and to leave The Observer, because I was like, I'm only ever going to be seen first as the feature writer on The Observer if I stay here. And secondly, I need to prove to myself that I can do it. And so it turned out. And my next book was The Party, and that became a bestseller. And you know, on a practical level as well, it also meant that when The Party was published, I could promote it by writing for lots of other papers, because I was entirely freelance and I hadn't been able to do that before. And now I'm at a stage where I'm setting boundaries according to what things I will say yes to. So I've now worked out that I've got three categories, and I call them the three P's, and I write about this in the book as well, I think. and they have to fulfill, if someone comes to me wanting me to do something very kindly, they have to fulfill one of the three P's. So they are passion, prestige, or pay. So passion, because I feel passionately about it, or it feels like it's integral to the vocation of writing books. Prestige, because it's good for, terrible word, my brand or my profile, something yes. like that, or it's a publication that I really want to be associated with, and pay, if you know, that's an obvious one, if the pay is really good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but enough. I think those things are really important for women, and probably a lot of men as well, just really work out in their heads. You have to start by taking yourself seriously, and then other people will.
Yeah. What was, you know, the initial couple of months after you left The Observer, when you were out in the world, was it invigorating? Was it nerve-wracking?
It was both invigorating and nerve-wracking. So for 4 days after I handed in my notes at The Observer, I was on this wild adrenaline high. I was suddenly like, oh my god, I'm so free. And then the reality sets in of will I be able to earn enough money to make a living? I remember asking my friend Olivia, will I ever be able to buy clothes again? She was like, yes, it'll be fine. And the first few months were actually I moved into this flat that we're sitting in. I had moved out of my marital home. I was...
So it all happened kind of around the same time.
Yeah, it did. And that I'd got used to the feeling of confusion and fear and panic, occasional panic, and I knew that it passed. So the sort of the panic that I would occasionally get, where I would think, what am I doing? What's happening next in my life? I've no idea. I knew that if I could just hang on to the present moment, that tended to pass. So I was quite familiar with that feeling, and I knew how to deal with it. But it was invigorating, because I suddenly thought, gosh, I can write for all of these people. How wonderful. And actually, because I'd been at The Observer for 8 years and I'd been a journalist for 5 years before that, a lot of people knew me and had expressed an interest in having me write for them. So that was really reassuring. But it was massively nerve-wracking. And that first year, I said yes to every single piece of work. Forget the three P's. I was just like, I will do anything, because I wanted to establish myself and have enough money in the bank.
What's your starting point for a novel? Do you generally have a kind of, does it sneak up on you that you have a plot that you're interested in? Or do you sit down and think, right, what am I doing next?
No, I like to allow ideas to sneak up on me. And I'm a big believer in the right idea coming at the right time, and that you just actually need to be patient and let it happen. And a lot of the time, if an idea isn't coming for me, it will be because I'm overworked.
Yeah.
And I need to just allow myself some space to let thoughts percolate. And actually, it's partly why exercise is really important to me, because I spend so much time in my head that I need to physically get back into my body. And actually, when I'm doing exercise, because I'm not working and I listen to music again, I find that's a very fertile time for thoughts to come, when you're not actively making a decision to think about things. And so generally, it depends for each novel, but generally I will have an idea of a character or a thing that I want to explore. So with Paradise City, Paradise City is about a billionaire businessman whose daughter goes missing. And this isn't a plot spoiler, because it happens in the first chapter, but the first chapter, this billionaire businessman, Howard Pink, sexually assaults a hotel chambermaid, and then you follow his story and you also follow her story, and then you follow the stories of two other Londoners. It's all set in London, and all of their stories turn out to be interlinked, and you read on to find out why. That was very much inspired by a news story at the time, which was Dominic Strauss-Kahn, who was the head of the International Monetary Foundation, who had been accused by a hotel chambermaid of sexual assault. And I thought, how horrendous for her, but also how fascinating it would be to follow her story as well as his. And I was on The Observer at the time, and I got sent to cover Dominic Strauss-Kahn's subsequent trial, not for that incident, but for a charge in France that's called aggravated pimping. And it was about the fact that he'd sort of allegedly slept with prostitutes and so on and so forth, and been part of this ring. And that gave me an extraordinary insight into that man's emotional, or lack of, makeup.
Is the act of writing always enjoyable for you, or do you have that thing of it's incredibly painful and I hate it the whole time it's going on until suddenly I've got a novel and then I'm happy.
I definitely don't always find it enjoyable, but I always find it stimulating, I suppose. I always am glad that I've done it. It's a bit like that thing of thinking, I don't want to go to a yoga class, I don't want to go to yoga, I don't want to go, I don't, I'm going, I'm here. And then afterwards you're like, I'm so glad I went.
Yeah, always, yeah.
There's never a time. Exactly, you never regret it. So that's how I feel about writing. I have never felt tortured by writing. I think that there is a not very helpful pose of the tortured creative artist. And I personally feel it's a bit indulgent. And like, you're actually, I'm incredibly privileged to write for a living. I really am. And what a beautiful thing that I can sit at my desk in my flat in Kentish Town and produce words. I mean, that's a beautiful gift. And therefore, I just don't subscribe to the notion that art has to come through pain and suffering.
Do you think your writing has improved over your career? And what do you think were the kind of breakthrough realizations that changed things?
I do think my writing's improved, and I like to think that I'm getting better, just generally at life,
yeah.
Let alone writing. But the breakthrough moments, it's so funny, I can literally remember specific moments. One of them was I studied history as a degree, and because I'd written all of my life, I thought that writing was very much my thing. So I thought when I was writing essays, okay, someone might disagree with my points, or they might think that I've got this wrong, or that I haven't marshalled my facts correctly. But the one thing that they can't argue with is my writing, the quality of my writing. I've been told that my writing is quite good. And so I suppose I wouldn't say I was arrogant, but I thought, this is the thing that I can do, and this is me, this is what I do. And I remember one particular tutor, and I felt so hurt by this, and I remember him marking one of my essays and saying, this is way too florid and you're using far too many words and it comes across as really pretentious. And I can remember it so vividly, and it took me a really long time to realise that he was right.
I think that's such a common problem among young writers, that you're pouring your heart and soul into it and overdoing it a lot of the time with too much of your heart and soul that's not necessary for the argument or whatever.
Yes, yes. That was one point. Another point was when I was a news reporter on the Sunday Telegraph and I really wanted to get into features, there was a features editor there who took me aside, and again I found this immensely hurtful, but she said, you really have to work on your linking sentences. And I'd never really understood what a linking sentence was, and it's a sentence that links two paragraphs, and I thought that I sort of did them okay. But then she told me to go away and read this other journalist, and she was like, you know, see how they do it. And I could see what she meant, and it's actually a very handy tip. Because when you really concentrate on the link between paragraphs, what you're doing is you're making the journey so much smoother for the reader, and they'll get to the end and they'll be astonished that they've read it all, because they can't help but read the next paragraph because you're making it interesting for them. So that was another really important thing. And I think I use that in my novels in terms of when I end chapters. I try to end a chapter on a note which will make the reader absolutely want to read the next one.
Yeah. And you do it very effectively.
Thank you. So that was a real really important. And then the third and final very important moment for me was meeting my book editor, Helen Garnons Williams, who has edited all of my books, and she's just incredible, and she understands me, and she's so on my side, even when she says things that are hard to assimilate or hard on a practical level to do. Everything she's ever said to me, everything she's ever advised, has turned out to be right.
My next question was going to be, who sees your writing first? But it sounds like you've just answered that question.
Yes, yeah. It is. It's Helen and Nell, my agent. But yeah, it's Helen is the person I trust the most with it.
Yeah.
And I'm not someone, I don't like to send my writing as I'm doing it to a focus group of other authors or to friends. I really don't. When you criticize me, you have to be quite careful in how you express it, because I am really quite thin-skinned. I've worked hard on that. I try not to be, but I think a lot of writers are extremely sensitive. You have to be to like let the world in. And Helen knows how to do it. Whatever Helen says never feels like a criticism. It feels like she's collaborating on this project and she wants to make it better. Yeah. And then when I've written the book, when I've written the whole thing, then it's up for grabs, really. It would probably be Justin, my other half. And if dear friends ask to read it at that stage, then I'll send it to them. But I always need to get the okay from Helen, and then I feel okay about it.
Yeah. So in the last year, you've launched your podcast, which has become this incredible hit. And you were saying you're working on the fifth season. Is it lovely to have this other string to your bow that doesn't involve sitting down at a laptop and writing something?
It's really lovely. And one of the things that I've most valued about the podcast is being able to do interviews how I want to do interviews. Because previously, the only interviews I would ever do would be for newspapers or magazines. And when you're writing an interview for a publication, clearly that publication has its own agenda. The editor will want you to ask certain things and you will only have a certain word count. And it was always a frustration to me that I often felt that some of the most revealing stuff or the most personal stuff or the thing that I found the most interesting about the person that I was meeting had to be left on the cutting room floor just for space purposes. And so I've loved being able to interview people about the things that I find interesting and putting it out there into the wide world almost exactly as the interview was done, and finding that connect with so many people has been such a wonderful, wonderful and beautiful discovery for me. So yeah. I've really loved doing that, and it's taught me so much about not just failure. I think it's all related to failure, but it's taught me about emotional resilience and the human spirit, and it's taught me about how we exist separately from our thoughts. And it's been life-changing for me in terms of the people that I've met and what I've learned from them. So
I see that you're someone who gives a lot to people. That's quite clear just through even your social media as well as the podcast. Does that in any way compromise your work life? Do you ever feel that you're slightly pulled in too many directions?
I do feel, it's been a really interesting few months because it's been incredible and I'm so grateful for it. And I'm so grateful for all of the people who listen to the podcast and who read the book. And I'm so honoured by the messages that I get. And
it really resonates with people, clearly.
Yeah. And they're really incredibly moving messages. And people come up to me at live shows and do me the honour of sharing their stories with me. And that's so wonderful. But I also have to continue to make a living. And I love everything that I do. It's just that there's been quite a lot of admin around it. So there's been enormous uptick in the amount of emails I get. And I know that sounds relatively stupid, but actually answering those emails was taking up so much of my time. And I wasn't able to do the things that I most wanted to do, which was write books, write the column, do the podcast, and the things that I get the most joy out of and the things that are most important in my life. And now I've got some systems in place. So I put an out of office on my email, which probably seems to the people who get it annoying and very grand. But honestly, it is a way of preserving my sanity.
Yeah.
And that has freed up a lot of mental space, because I feel very guilty if I don't reply to emails, and that's not that great to feel guilt constantly. And the other thing I realized was that my diary, just actually sort of scheduling my diary and fitting everything in, was meaning that I wasn't seeing my closest friends, and that's really important to me, I've now realized. I sort of knew it before, but on a very practical level, it's really important for me to see my closest friends, to spend time with them, and to feel nurtured just by being in their presence. And I'm someone who's lucky in that I've got a large group of friends and acquaintances and lovely colleagues and stuff. But it has been very important to me to realise that those sort of five people are the ones that I need to prioritise. And ironically, they're often the ones who don't ask for your time.
Yeah.
So unless you prioritise them, you end up just being sucked in, yeah, a thousand different directions.
Yeah. What's the thing that you've done professionally that you're the most proud of? Or what are you most proud of in your professional life?
I'm most proud of How to Fail. I'm going to have more than one, but I think
book or podcast?
Both. Okay. I see them as so inextricably intertwined. But the reason I'm most proud of that is because I feel that it's the culmination of a lot of work that I've done to get to this point. So it's a culmination of what I've learned through journalism, in the form of the interviews that I do. It's also what I've learned from writing books, because I wrote the book alongside it. And it's also what I've learned from life and through some of the darkest patches of my life. And what I realised particularly when I was writing the book, is that when I was being most honest about the things that had been most difficult for me and that I felt were most personal, those are the moments that have turned out to have the greatest connection. And that has been a really wonderful realization for me, because it's made me realize that actually, if I'm more myself, not less, if I lean into the absolute truthfulness of who I am, that's when good stuff happens. And it's a lesson that I'm taking into my novels as well. And about being, I know that it's an overused word, but authentic and real and honest. So I'm most proud of that. But I'm also extremely proud of writing novels. And, you know, the first time I saw my first novel in the Waterstones was a very, very proud moment. And I'm really proud of some of the pieces of journalism I wrote for The Observer, because I think that they gave me the opportunity to bring stories of vulnerable people to light. And so there's some of the stuff that I've done there I'm really proud of as well.
Thank you so much to Elizabeth Day, who is one of the journalism world's great charmers. I have more equally brilliant guests coming up on the podcast in future episodes. So if you enjoyed it, please help me out by subscribing and leaving a rating and review. I hear that in some mysterious algorithmic way, this helps it reach a wider audience. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.